Welcome. We are so happy you decided to join us for part two of our discussion with Kunal Mehta. It's been a great discussion thus far. Hopefully you'll enjoy the rest. All the best. So one area for us to kind of bounce over to before we even move on is, you know, with all of that that you just described, how do you leverage metrics into all of this to that point? And how do you ensure that your sales leaders and even sales reps who, you know, really aren't built for metrics, they're not typically accounting majors or finance majors or engineers or anything like that. They want to, you know, they other than their revenue and their commission checks, they typically don't want to spend too much time thinking of mathematical equations and tracking those things. How do you leverage that into your approach to really make sure you're getting the organization to move in ways that you'd like to see them and track that every step of the way?
Yeah, Mark, it's a good question. Like one of the biggest takeaways that we learned from Vista Equity is they had a program where they hired high potential entry level folks. And we know they were smart and they had great fit inside the organization, but they may have never been in customer success. They may have never been in software or technology at all. They could have come, you know, we had bartenders, we had Uber drivers, we had people from all walks of life, but we knew they were smart. They just had never been given an opportunity. When you're bringing on a lot of folks like that, what Vista teaches you to do is be ruthlessly simple with the metric.
That makes sense. Awesome. So then how does that tie to cross-functional teams and how you need to structurally build them and architect them? And then, you know, again, giving them the right tools and motivation to really work in a cross-functional way, and especially tying that back to customer-centric messaging again as well. And one of the ways that I've used that, and I know you have too, is by building more of a pod structure in some of this stuff that you do and you know, just to make sure that collaboration is first and foremost. How do you make sure that your companies that you work with really are able to leverage that type of a mindset as well?
I'll give you an example, Mark. Like if I follow the thread on the Vista Hipple analogy, if we had customer success and we had new folks coming in, we knew from our previous work that if we triple the, let's say a new logo closes and we have three contacts. If we triple the number of contacts in that account in year one and tripled it in year two, we knew that we had completely mitigated the risk of the champion leaving at that point. So how are we going to measure new customer success folks? It's not only their ability to add new contacts, but it changes how we onboard as well. So we're not just trying to get you activated on using network technology as an example. We're going to ask who in legal wrote the policy for X, who in security is responsible for Y. So we're actively going out and we're increasing the number of contacts that we're moving the needle on the renewal rate. So, you know, every time we triple contact, we got the renewal. Every time we did this, the renewal rate was over 95%. But we also combined it with, you know, sales. If I take this notion of 3-2-1, so what 3-2-1 is, it was a project that we ran where we wanted to know if a opportunity had an 80% chance to close. So again, if I'm selling networking software and I have a relationship with them, if I have a relationship with security, I have a relationship with procurement, that's the three, the kind of three buying centers. If I have two contacts in each, and the way we defined a contact was an engaged contact. So if I text you and you text me back, that counts as a contact. And if I had a champion, when I achieved 3-2-1, those opportunities closed 80% of the time across our portfolio. So it changes how we enable for new logos. But again, think about that first line customer success person. Now they're taking two metrics, 3-2-1 and 3X. And that's what we're measuring them on. You know, I think the thing that companies outside of the Vista portfolio often do is there's just too many metrics a person is measured on. And I think the biggest lesson learned from Vista is getting down to the being ruthlessly simple, I would say, on a metric to evaluate someone and measure their success because of the folks we had in place.
Yeah, that's interesting on the one metric. Was it the determining the 3-2-1? Because I think that's very interesting. Was that really, how did that present itself in a sense? Was that coming from, did you look at sort of post-sale, like, okay, we're going to go do a retroactive on that win, or we're actually just crunching through the numbers and the data and it just sort of became evident through the Salesforce system? Or was it through, how was that exercise done, or how did you actually figure out the 3-2-1 was the magic sort of formula? Yeah,
that's a great question, because I think one of the advantages, if you're a large buyout private equity firm that you have, in Vista's case, you installed a business operating framework. So the tech stack was very consistent. The way it was run was extremely consistent. And what that allows you to do is normalize data across many portfolio companies and draw insights that I don't think any one company on their own would get. So I think the advantage that they had was to be able to draw these insights out of the power of hundreds of acquisitions versus any one company being able to do it on their own. And I think that's what makes them very special in terms of their performance, is they're able to use this data to drive how they're going to run the company.
In a sense, it's their own benchmarks across their portfolio companies to kind of have out there. Well, Mark, I know we had a couple other topics we definitely wanted to make sure we don't run out of time with Kunal on. And I think, you know, going back to how you use data within an organization cross-functionally or cross-collaboration, right? And how do you make sure, and it was interesting now just listening to the Vista thing, that some of this might actually just come pre-baked, right, in a Vista portfolio company. But for others that you work with, you know, how do you implement this cross collaboration between teams when it just comes to how they're looking at and sharing data?
Yeah, I think the way I think about it, the two biggest points of lift are, one, prioritizing which accounts you go after, because when you do that, what we found is like 86% of close won comes from A accounts or companies with the highest propensity to expand or buy new. What in those projects, we also find 1 in 5 A accounts have no sales coverage. And we also find two other things. The marketing wiring is almost always broken. And then marketing is generating a lot of noise in non-A accounts. So that lift one is like, just by knowing the richest ponds or richest areas to fish in, you're going to generate a lot of lift. The other thing that we found is territories were out of balance almost 100% of the time. So if Mark has 10, you know, or if I have 10 D accounts and Mark has 10 A accounts, but we have the same quota, the person with the D accounts might actually be a better rep, especially if they're hitting quota, because they have a bad territory. So again, you're going to balance the territories. You're going to make sure everybody has the best accounts to go after. You're going to aim marketing. So that's lift one. Lift two, to your integrated, getting an integrated motion going, is through what I would call a sales play system. Most people, when they run sales plays, it might have a bad taste because everybody's going to say they run sales plays. But when I talk about a system, I think there's 5 components to a system, right? Am I even running the right play? So if I know in the previous example, Workday has a 3.5 times higher win rate, I might naturally say, hey, let's go after all companies where Workday is installed, but avoid all companies where SAP is installed because we have a low win rate. So now that I know that with a lot of precision, what's my enablement need to be across the different roles? What's the BDRs need to do to gain? What do they need to do to gain access? How do I make sure my reps, when they do have that first meeting, it's successful? And how do I measure that? And then, as I move down as I think about that sales play, once I've gained access, what worked? What did not work? Did my message resonate? Did it not resonate? I need to be really agile at updating the content in that process. And then what's moving things across, the opportunity lifecycle? I think a good sales play system is taking one play and evaluating it end to end on what's working and what's not working and testing and learning in a really agile way. Bain would call that a win room, the where that happens. But it's taking a play end to end and every aspect of it. It's almost like a test and learn approach for this one play. But believe it or not, it's hard to build the muscle into the organization because they have so much, you know, muscle memory on how they've done it before. So you often end up micromanaging play, you know, this system for 2, 3, 4, 5 plays until the muscle kind of gets developed internally. Then the company can execute these things on their own. But the combination of propensity modeling and running kind of a system of sales plays it generates such a huge ROI. It almost pays for every other aspect of a go-to-market transformation.
So Kunal, take us a little deeper into propensity modeling and the impact that that brings. And then also just how just leveraging these analytics that we all have access to now, whether you're a big company or a small company. Take us a little deeper into that and, you know, even some stories or some standout instances where you've experienced this and you just kind of moved the needle in even additional ways.
Right. So when I think like the nutshell version of propensity modeling is I'm taking in all of your first party data from the CRM, the billing system, marketing, but I'm enriching it with a lot of third party data. So that could be something like HG Insight. So I have the technographic data. I know what's kind of installed, especially with my competitors. Or I might ultimately say, like, there's positive correlation when X, Y, and Z are involved, I have a higher win rate. But at TCV, we were able to syndicate across, you know, 60 different data sources. The reason you have so many is like, hey, for education, there's a data source, for government, for state and local. You start to blow up the number. But in general, like, you're going to use Zoom and HG Insights to start, and then you'll figure out the other ones you want to use. Some people might add intent, some people might add other stuff. But once you do that, the modeling, you're basically building a correlation model that says which variables are predictive in terms of predicting really who has a high propensity to expand or who has a high propensity to buy new. And for my for existing accounts, it's like you could say it's almost lookalike modeling at scale. So if I'm in the airline industry, Delta might spend, you know, $10 a head on cloud, and American might spend $2. You know, the insight there is like maybe American has more room to run on the cloud spend, as an example. So so the propensity modeling helps really in a lot of detail give you the high propensity accounts, but the way it works is get the existing data, enrich it with third party data, build a model that tells you like which products you should sell more of or who has a, you know, the propensity to buy new. And if I think of results, Mark, I think you know, the numbers that I gave, you know, if it's done well, 86% of the time, Your A accounts are going to generate 86% of your close one should come from A accounts. You know, that's probably the biggest takeaway when you know a propensity model is built well.
I have a follow-on question in terms of that, again, just drilling down into that critical cross-functional communications and linking the groups together. Sounds like, you know, there's a way to kind of benchmark across the sales and marketing and rev op organization. But in smaller companies, let's say, you know, mid-size sort of tech, you know, maybe a couple years into it, getting back to product and product marketing, you know, that's where I see a big fall off in companies. Just, you know, they might be the sales organization is out doing that, but just that feedback's not getting and muscling through the product organization. What are some tips there? How do you know when things aren't going well, maybe, you know, in terms of there's a disconnect?
Yeah. So if I take that win room concept, it's often going to be cross-functional in nature with marketing, sales, product in the room. So we know kind of what's everybody's on the same page in terms of the metrics that we're managing. But we also know, like, hey, when this thing doesn't progress, why doesn't it progress? If it does, why is it progressing? But the other kind of corollary is win-loss. And there's two critical components of win-loss. One is setting up your CRM to track the win-loss and making sure the reps fill those fields out. And again, if there's a lot of data on this. If you have more than 10 fields, you have a huge drop-off. If you start using nesting, you have a huge drop-off. But we generally have a really strong method to say, let's just capture some quantitative data on why we're winning and losing. But then we have the qualitative piece where, you know, if a deal size is over X and we win or lose, we want to make sure a product manager is interviewing the rep on those. So the product management team will have the ability and we will set up the questions that they need to ask to make sure that they're getting the insight, the qualitative insight. But I think the biggest unlock is using a third party to also go in and evaluate almost on a blinded basis why you're winning and losing. And maybe in like 5% of your wins and losses, you're using a third party to really understand. Otherwise, it always ends up with price or we didn't have this specific feature. If we really want to get to the root cause, I think you have the quantitative piece and how your CRM is set up. You have the agile piece and the product managers taking on a certain percentage of the win-loss interviews. And then you have a third party going in and getting real insight on, you know, why people are winning, why they're losing. Was the sales, those questions that I ask, what are you selling? You know, who are you selling to and what do you need to sell more? You can almost reverse those when you're talking to our customers. It's like, what did you buy? Who did you buy from and did we solve the problem? And that way you can kind of triangulate between what you're hearing internally and what you're hearing externally as well.
Yeah, and as we know, no decision and resistance to change are two of the biggest reasons for loss, right? It's
exactly.
Not even a-
exactly. And I'm sure you've seen that in your roles before as well.
So Kunal, you know I'm not going to let you leave us until we talk some about sales plays and the power and what that brings and how that pulls together a true integrated go-to-market execution approach or fabric. And you know what I think of sales plays and how valuable they are. Tell us a little bit about how you use them, how important you think they are, and the same thing, maybe a story or two where it's really, really moved the needle and impacted the, you know, your one of your clients or multiple clients along the way.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say like the very first sales play project was with a food services company that we're not generating a lot of new logos, right? When they actually started focusing, marketing and sales started focusing on new logos, I think the first play they ran generated like $20 million. This is a multi-billion-dollar company, but it was a $20 million like win for them. But if you think about it, where was the time spent? What sales play should they run? You know, it was in hospitals with this many beds, with this makeup, in this geo where we already had a certain number of players in place, and had this score in a definitive healthcare database. Where we knew they weren't satisfied with their current food vendor, as an example. So we're able to build a model that says these are the hospitals that we should go after. So then what's the most, you know, what is the enablement we need to run? Because this company was just generating a lot of inbound to actually start doing outbound. What does the BDR need to do to actually gain access into these companies? What's, you know, one of the biggest unlocks, you know, I've seen is like, when you email to gain access, those only convert to new meetings at 0.26%. So that is a lot of emails to spend, you know, send out. And you have like really restrictive email practices right now that you need to follow so you don't get blacklisted. If you pick up the phone and call, 2.8% of those calls convert to a meeting. So it's 10 and a half times more effective. And then if you're able to track follow-up, 10% of your people you follow up with. So if Kathy asked me for a white paper and I send it to her and I follow up a week later, 10% of those follow-ups convert to a meeting. I see people over emailing, like 95% of their efforts on emailing. So it's in a low. I see almost 95% not doing any follow-up whatsoever. They're not able to track it outside of a really complicated, you know, build a task process inside their CRM. So again, that's how do you enable each role to be successful? We just talked about the BDR there. There's what does sales need to do? What does marketing need to do? I think the third component is what does marketing need to do? What is the message that they need to send out? Who are they sending it out to? one of the most productive fuel lines, I would say, is like closed loss. Who did you lose to? Or how many leads have you not followed up on? Let's squeeze everything out of those. Closed loss is often not closed loss. It's closed loss for like lots of reasons. Like cleanup is probably the most common reason things get closed loss. But we've already know who to talk to. We already know that they were interested at one point. These fuel lines generate like tons of actual closed one. If you come back, or they might have bought something and they didn't successfully implement it. So again, there's lots of sales plays you can figure out how to run. And then, you know, what is the role of the sales rep? You know, one of the ways we've activated these things is through a call down day. So I might be competing with like two or three teams, and the people that generate the most meetings, we're going to do bragging rights matter a lot in sales. But we, you know, there could be a reward at the end of the day for a call down day. And then finally, we track that all the way to close one. There's a different machine or a different tactic that goes on to continually move stuff through the pipeline. But Mark, the thing that I don't see is a sales play generally generates very little revenue unless it's really pushed through the system in a really, you know, meaningful way. It's often generates a hollow return.
Yeah, like the closed lost for now, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, then to make sure you're going back, and it's just one of the seven no's that you're going to get in the process, and, you know, to engage in them. But I agree with you in terms of that. You have to have demonstrated success in a sales play somewhere in the organization for others to kind of emulate that and want to lean in, or else it's just another kind of thing that's pushed down that people, you know, hope for, but maybe don't see the results.
Yeah. And often when we're working with marketing, for example, that the number one objection is we run sales plays already. And just if I look at some of the data that I think your listeners will really like, is like we ran a study that basically said, if when I go out to market and look for a solution, 86% of the time, I will pick three vendors that I want to bring and look at. But 92% of the time, they choose one of those three vendors. So if I'm not on the day one list, I almost have no chance of winning. So there's a critical role for marketing to make sure we are on the day one list. And again, there's lots of data we can go to marketing with to make sure like we can overcome the objection that we ran sales plays before.
Yeah, you never want to be getting that RFP in with not ever hearing about it and knowing you have a week to get it back. So
yeah, exactly.
Well, Mark, how are we doing on time and getting...
We're doing great. Yeah, let's move towards some questions that we're going to be asking most of our guests as we go along here. We'll do a little bit of a rapid fire on this. So, and I'll just rotate them one at a time here. So, Kunal, what was the first product or service you ever sold?
Help desk software.
Great. Favorite CEOs that you follow?
I think my favorite CEO is the guy who founded IDEO, David Kelly, because it was just an entirely new way to think about coming to the problem or solving the problem.
So he's the favorite. Any other ones that you follow?
I mean, I love Warren Buffett just because, like, one, he's like a legendary asset allocator, but two, he's good for a lot of great quotes too.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. I know the answer to this one already because it's my answer to this. But yeah, tell us which tool you'd recommend to every CRO who's watching.
Yeah, I recommend a tool called Collective Eye because I am 95% certain without any human intervention, I'm going to get an accurate forecast.
Yeah, it's incredible. And so much more as well. So I thought I knew the one you were going to say, and I turned out to be right. Okay, things you wish that the 21-year-old you knew.
Don't work for assholes.
How do you figure that out?
Because like I've had a few of those, and I kind of muscled through. But if I had to go back and give advice, I'd be like, it doesn't get better.
Yeah. But,
and just to kind of, for 2 seconds, go off the thing, you know, when you say that, what matters to you in a leader, you know, from your perspective?
Yeah. So what mattered to me, like, again, if I'm telling a 21-year-old, I would say, you know, how much can you learn from the leader? How good is the role? Is it a role you can continue to grow in? I'd say, and then what are the other people like to work with? Are you learning from there as well? Like when I'm looking at a role, like the boss, the job, the pay, and then, you know, are you working on good stuff? I think those are really important things.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny, the more times you work with bad leaders, the better you are at predicting who is going to be really good ones and who maybe is not. So it is a little harder at 21 probably than 31 or 41, but it's something to look at. Sometimes you can look at the product or the opportunity or how much value and enterprise value you think is going to be built by this company. It's really important to factor in the people, the mindset right from the beginning. So how will the role of the CRO evolve in 2024?
I think they're getting hit up with a lot of generative AI messaging right now, and they'll just need to be able to separate noise from actually what's going to move the needle. I talked about Collective Eye earlier. That's using a lot of AI in the background, but it's also just telling me the forecast, which is giving me time back. So I don't have to spend so much time internally on getting the forecast. So I would say on your generative AI or on your journey, make sure you're able to separate, you know, the noise from what's actually going to move the needle. But I think every CRO is probably getting hit up with like, hey, you need to be doing this.
Perfect. And then I know you won't say these because you wouldn't throw these out there, but your favorite sales book, and it can't be Selling the Cloud or Data and Diagnosis Driven Selling, but I know you can do better than even those two. So which is your favorite book?
This one sits on my shelf, Cracking the Sales Management Code, because it almost has every metric that I would ever want to track in there, really well laid out and measured. And how to calculate it. So again, I think it's just an encyclopedia of things to look at. Ultimately, though, you got to get to the ruthlessly simple one that's going to move the needle.
Awesome. What about business book, non-sales focused?
I think Good to Great is my favorite book. I mean, it's not just about getting the right people on the bus, but it's like, are the people on the bus in the right seat? You know, often companies have amazing people in place, they're just in the wrong seat. And there's, I think, the ability to go from good to great is ensuring you not only have great people, but they're all doing, you know, they're all sitting in the right seat as well.
Yeah, I would say it's one of the most rewarding things. And I'm interested if anything pops to your head where you've made a move for someone, like someone you see someone struggling and you've recognized and you sort of, hey, have you tried X, maybe a younger person, has that happened and you've seen someone flourish in a different role? It's just one of the better things of being a manager and working to kind of develop somebody, put them in the right direction.
I think anytime you're coming into a leadership role and you're evaluating the talent, you're trying to figure that out. You know, at Infoblox, I had a guy running content for education, and that wasn't his strain. We actually made him the leader of the team. And the team grew from like a million to 10 million over the course of like a 3-year period. He had all the natural skills of being a great GM and also, how to build an ecosystem that's going to support, you know, how he's going to get to that number. But he didn't have all the skills to be a great content, you know, creator of education material, which is like, you know, you got to go through those things 1,000 times to make sure they work. That wasn't his thing, but he ultimately became the leader of the group and he was amazing.
Awesome. Kunal, this has been incredible. Thank you so much for taking the time with us. And Kathy, thanks for being here as well.
Yeah,
good to be here. Thanks, Kunal. It's just a lot of fun. Thanks, Mark.
You bet. Take care.